particularly with a theme like how events and cities innovate to thrive, because this is certainly a model of a city that on every front we're discussing it here today, sport, business, culture, has innovated and thrived in terms of attracting major events. And we've been privileged and honoured to work with Glasgow on some of the sporting side and attracting some of those great events here, including most recently the World Artistic Gymnastic Championships. My company, Vero, we specialise in helping cities and countries bid for major events. We've got a reasonably good track record on that front. We've also worked a lot with individuals. Seb's trying to get hold of you, Craig. And one of those campaigns we were involved in recently was with Louise Martin for her to become the new president of the Commonwealth Games Federation. I think Louise is here, and congratulations to Louise. That's all a part of British influence spreading around the world, and we were delighted that Louise got such a great result. In terms of this particular session, you know, I think that one of the things that certainly in the campaigns and the work that we do with federations, with cities, with countries, is about developing powerful narratives. Sorry about this, I should have switched that off. One thing that didn't happen was the plane landing on time, so I haven't got totally prepared, it's off. Those narratives increasingly, as we look at across the, certainly our area, the sports environment, have increasingly wanted innovation, wanting new thinking, wanted people to bring new narratives to their events, to their hosting. And certainly Agenda 2020, created by Thomas Bach, the IOC president, has encouraged that, I think, and that's beginning to filter through across the sporting environment. And certainly innovation around issues like sustainability and legacy have become increasingly important, but also in your location for events, being innovative about where you may put traditional events that could even lie outside the city, bringing them into the city centre, and also in areas such as sports presentation. So there's it's a changing environment, a very competitive environment, certainly in sport, but I also know in terms of business and cultural events. And it's particularly good that this whole 2 days is actually bringing the three dimensions together. That's fairly unique, actually, in my experience. They tend to be in their own silos, so it's good that we're thinking across the piece as cities like Glasgow do when they think about what they want to host and what's going to be the benefits that are brought to the city of them being engaged in these major events. So I think this idea of building innovation to thrive, but that also being linked to long-term legacy, to economic benefit, the development of skills and training, better infrastructure, new venues, is all a part, I hope, of this conversation. And linked to it is bidding for things that are appropriate. And I do remember a conversation in a number of cities where they're keen to bid for the Olympics. You might think we would advise them to do so because that's partly where we make our business. But actually, no. You know, bid for things that are appropriate and that are right for you and can bring maximum benefit to your city and to your country. So we've got a great panel, and I'll invite them to join us as I go through the names. First of all, he's already spoken, I know, got quite a busy day. He may be on the phone to Geneva later, is Sir Craig Reedy, Vice President of the International Olympic Committee and President of WADA. Craig. Dr. Bridget McConnell, CBE, Chief Executive of Glasgow Life. And I know Bridget's been very much involved in driving what I've described earlier as the very innovative policies of Glasgow. Dimitri Kezentes, Councillor and Chief of Staff of World Expos. And those who know that scene know the significance of hosting a World Expo and the increasing number of cities that are seeking to bid for that. Carol Bartak, the Head of Culture Unit at the European Commission and in charge of the Capital of Culture programme. David Grevenberg, Chief Exec of the Commonwealth Games Federation. And I can tell you from my sources at Buckingham Palace that today is a big day for David. Actually, I got it off Twitter because he's been awarded the CBE. So congratulations to David. And there's me, I'm going to moderate it, so do join us, please. panel. That's I can hear myself as well. So I'm going to start by throwing a question to each of the panelists, and I'm going to start actually with David, in honour of his CBE, which is really to talk about innovation, and particularly obviously David's role as CEO of Glasgow 2014, a magnificent success as a tournament and as an event, but also one that was spoken about because of some of the innovative things that it engaged with. So maybe David, to highlight what you thought was one of the most innovative elements of what you did here in Glasgow for the Commonwealth Games.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you for pointing out the recent honour. You know, I think I came to Glasgow about six years ago after spending quite a lot of time with the International Paralympic Committee for 11 years living in Bonn, Germany. And what really attracted me to this city was the boldness. The boldness of trying to do things different and trying to do things not just to achieve an outcome, but to actually take a journey on how to achieve it. So it was just as much about what we were achieving as it was how we were going to achieve it. And I was really here very much as a student in terms of really learning how a city could run a great games for all the right reasons. And really what it came down to was people and partnerships and getting people to overcome their anxieties around, my goodness, we've won this and it's the biggest thing since the creation of the world, and actually calming down the anxieties and getting people to realize and achieve their ambitions and be innovative. Glasgow already had a great consciousness. It was just just releasing that, and I had a very privileged role to play in that by just getting great people to work together, including our organizing committee, which is, which was very much a very time-based organization. That was the new kid on the block that was going to come and go. But how did we actually work with those that were going to endure with the legacy beyond? And I think, if there's one thing I had to pick out that was really, I'm really proud to have been associated with, was certainly the social and legacy consciousness that we got everyone to work with. And I think when I talk about that, it was how do we use this strictly as an investment in our future? Just because we have it doesn't mean we need to spend it. And if we are going to spend it, let's spend it in the right areas. And I think what we tried to do in many cases, make sure that every point that we, every milestone we achieved resonated with accessibility and inclusivity for all. And I think that was a narrative that the entire partnership subscribed to, held each other accountable to, through thick or thin, through good conversations or difficult conversations. And I think that approach, that was innovative in terms of its responsibility. As difficult, as hard as some of the conversations are, because there's different ambitions and different anxieties out there, I think the model that we've created, certainly for the city of Glasgow, will certainly endure for some time. So I would say very proud of the innovation of creating a legacy conscious model and approach to delivering major events for a greater cause.
Thank you, David. Bridget, I genuinely paid tribute to Glasgow, not just because I'm here and there's so many Glaswegians in the audience, but the way I think that you've been thinking about your strategy for some time in attracting major events here across the business and cultural and sporting front, I think has led the way actually throughout the UK. So I just wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what's behind that thinking and how it's been brought together.
Well, I think listening to Craig and before him Jim McDonald this morning, it just reminded me yet again that Glasgow and indeed Scotland has been a hugely ambitious city and country for hundreds and hundreds of years. and I could spend a long time taking you back to the great exhibitions of 1888 and later in the 1930s. But I think more recently, the very self-conscious promotion and embracing of culture and sport and events is probably from the 1980s, where the city took a very unusual decision to find a huge amount of resources at that time to build another international museum in a Burrell collection. Then in 1988, it had a garden festival. 1990, it was a city of culture. And lots of others, sporting events came from the mid-90s onwards, again, very self-consciously, where the council was very clear that events and sports development programs would not only improve the well-being and health of local people, but would do much to promote the city and its ambitions and therefore its economic regeneration strategies internationally. I think crucially, I mean, I often talk to people about Glasgow being a place of complete madness and brilliance, and I think it is two sides of the one coin. The city, despite events that might economically restrain other places, they have always, through innovation and through partnership, strove to actually do incredible things against all the odds. And again, looking at Louise Martin here, who has had such a dramatic impact on sports, not only in the Commonwealth Federation, but actually in her role in Sports Scotland. Those kinds of links with people like Louise have been absolutely pivotal to the success of a city. Agencies like Sports Scotland, and indeed agencies like the former Scottish Arts Council, now Creative Scotland, where there has been a real recognition that what we're all engaged in here is a celebration and promotion of the best of human achievement, and that everyone, whether they're brilliant athletes competing at the highest and most elite level, or someone in a community who's just needing a break to actually make a difference to their lives, that culture and sport can absolutely be the route in to do that. And I think that has been fundamental in terms of how we have approached major events. Legacy is an overused word, but from day one, when Louise and I and others from the Scottish Government in a city, in a bar in Manchester in 2002, over a few drinks, thought, Glasgow could not just do something as brilliant as Manchester, and I think the Manchester Games really showed how a city could display its character and its own unique character of its people, athletes and artists through something like the Games. But we really felt there was a moment of opportunity to use a major event not only to showcase brilliance, but also to accelerate the social and the economic strategies and policies of our city. So even when we looked at the costs of running events, immediately there was discussion about innovative ways of finding that funding, and I think that's crucial. So we were able to accelerate spending that we knew of, that was in the Greater Glasgow Housing Association at the time, which ultimately built the village. We knew that there had been plans and long-term thought in the Scottish Government about extending the M74, and was there a way of actually bringing that money forward earlier? And there were new regional and national sports strategies that were looking to secure new facilities like a velodrome and indoor arena. Again, could we coalesce all that funding and actually use that to find the resources? And I just want to say one final thing. The most significant thing here was that we really were rooted and locked into existing infrastructure at both national and local level. So the sports and cultural and volunteering structures that existed in the city, primarily in Glasgow Life, but in other agencies across Scotland, we were able to not only draw on the resources there in terms of funding, but most importantly, staff. And we have people like Colin Hartley with us here today, who was one of the prime movers in the development of Alive Sites and the integration of a sports and cultural programme, went on to become the director of the incredible World Gymnastics that we've just had, and as of this Monday is now director of the European Sports Championships for 2018. And I use Colin as an example because he's a microcosm of a story that's happened in many other contexts, building those skills through collaboration with events organisers and national agencies. So really crucial that that human upskilling and experience is rooted here in the city and isn't lost to the city and is used for future events.
Thank you, Bridget. Carol, one of the things that you'll remember is the fact this is, of course, previously a European capital of culture, and you've heard from Bridget about the integrated way they think. Looking from a European-wide perspective, what other cities would you highlight as having an approach that you would regard as innovative and creative?
Well, hello. The whole scheme started 30 years ago, and we are having the 30th anniversary this year. And it has developed quite a lot and has been improved and fine-tuned over the years. We have, you know, the first European Capital of Culture in 1985 in Athens, and the following ones were more kind of, you know, permanent one-year festival in a city more kind of traditionally oriented. And with the time and with the new requirements and with the experience which people started sharing over the time, it has become more kind of innovative. But it all depends on the city, because, you know, you can have a city which is rather small but very kind of innovation oriented, and you can have a very, very interesting program in a very, very small place like Umeå in Sweden last year, or in Leeuwarden in 3 years' time in the Netherlands, which are really high-tech, oriented. You can have very traditional programs in places where people feel that they prefer that. So it's a kind of, the geometry of the preparation is very different. And the most important is that the city starts preparing for the year something like 5-6 years in advance when it is selected. We have usually quite a strong competition for the European Capitals of Culture for the title. We have 23 cities competing for the title in Italy in 2021. We are now dealing with 14 cities competing in Romania for 2022, and so on. So there is a lot of appetite to host the title and to have the one-year program. And the jury, which is internationally composed, is always looking at the three main aspects. One is the European dimension of the program. That means that you bring European culture and the variety and the diversity into the city so that the inhabitants, the citizens, can feel it, and that the city, of course, attracts the attention of people from outside the city, from the region and from the whole country. And the second basic criterion is that you involve the local population, that you make people really participate in the program. So you have, on one hand, top-class European performances, and at the same time, local acts, local bands, local people participating as massively as possible in the program, taking ownership and taking the pride of their city being the European Capital of Culture. So these are the two main elements. And the third one, I would say, is the legacy, which was mentioned quite a lot already here today. But we are really very, very keen on having such a program and such a bid which will, increase the level of the cultural life in the city to stay. That means you don't have 1 year festival and then a cultural desert afterwards. That really, and this is what you are then, appreciating from the kind of a future point of view. And we have had very good examples. I think Liverpool was a very good example in England. People tell me who remember that the Glasgow was a very, very good European Capital of Culture. We have had Lille in France. We have had Marseille recently, again, cities which very probably would have never had such a level of cultural life today if it hadn't been for the European Capital of Culture. I was recently in Košice, which is a small town rather in the eastern part of Slovakia, and they were European Capital of Culture in 2013, and they were not considered to be really the best ones. All the investment which was made in the infrastructure and the restoration and so on was a bit late and so on, so the program really took off kind of in summer instead of the beginning of the year. But nowadays, everybody tells me in Slovakia that the cultural life of Košice can be easily compared to the cultural life of Bratislava, the capital. They have created jobs, they have generated growth, and they are really having cultural life, which was incomparable to the one before. So, you know, it is very different. You can have capitals for 5 million euros, like in Paphos in Cyprus in 2 years' time, but you can have capitals for 120 million of euros, like in Wrocław in Poland next year. So we are always adapting, of course, to the possibilities, and we are encouraging the cities to go as much as possible also towards the creative industries, to create creative hubs, to involve private businesses, which is not always easy, because for the time being, 70 to 90% of the budget comes from public funding, public sources, government, region, the city itself, and it is, of course, important to involve private businesses as much as possible. So that's basically what's being done with the capitals at this stage. The most important for us is, on one hand, to give the cities the possibility to prepare in such a way that they can plan for the funding from the European structural funds, so that they get, you know, supplementary money for infrastructure at the same time. And we are always trying to see with the jury that we have a political consensus at the beginning of the process, so that all the parties represented at the municipality somehow are keen to have the capital, because during the five-year period you will always necessarily have at least once elections, and very probably the majority of the city council is going to change. We have had recently a problem in Matera, which won the title for Italy for 2021, and all of a sudden the new mayor, who arrived a couple of days after the city got the title, dismissed completely the whole thing and said, well, we are not going to have this because these were other people who have come up with this. So there was a kind of negotiation. Now I think they are going to be a good capital. So this is important as well. Thank you.
Yeah, you can never account for Italian politics, that's for certain. Turning to Sir Craig, Craig, obviously many different hats, but thinking about more of your sort of pure sporting hats, where have you seen innovation in sport itself in terms of venues and also presentation?
A bit like me at the end of the day. thanks, Mike. Let me respond just quickly, if I can, to one thing that Carol said, that I think one of the big changes in Glasgow was the appointment as the European Capital of Culture. I'm furiously trying to remember how long ago it was. It came as something of a surprise to the average Glaswegian. I mean, I can remember one of the Glasgow newspapers saying, does this mean that next year we'll be the art hole of Europe? Which perhaps wasn't particularly helpful. But in terms of legacy, we have had for all these years an absolutely wonderful concert hall in this city, which has, there's no cultural desert here, and one of the reasons has been what was built for the European Year of Culture. As far as sport is concerned, I think there are a number of things that sport can do, and in association with cities who host events. Again, I don't want to over-labour the gymnastics championships that were here. But Glasgow, British Gymnastics and the International Federation presented the sport in a completely new way. Gymnastics, if you know, has about five different sports, different sports, vaulting, beam, floor and whatnot, in the same arena at the same time. And they always put all their judges. And gymnastics is a difficult sport because it's subjective judging that decides who wins. And instead of having three judges, they have about 3,000 judges around every piece of apparatus. And that's a pain in the butt for the organising committee, as you can remember, David, when you have to pay for all these people. But what Glasgow did and the British gymnastic people was to persuade the FIG that we should move these judges away from the area around the apparatus. And they were put almost as part of the crowd on either side. So there was absolutely nothing between the eye of the spectator and the athlete in the event. And the colours were great. It was all done in the Glasgow colours. They had a huge television screen, which is becoming not quite normal, but it's a terrific thing if you can afford to do it. It's innovative, but television isn't all that new as such. But the presentation on the floor was outstanding. Sport is encouraged, certainly by the IOC, to keep looking at itself, to see how it can present itself better. We did one thing in London, if you remember, Mike, was to concentrate a great effort on sports presentation. So we explained to people what was going to happen before the event started. We put music in the place, we put lights in the place, we tried to make it attractive. And that was because we had to sell £680 million of the tickets, 27% of our revenue, to make the games work. So we had a group who were looking after the spectator interests. And these two things combine very greatly. And sport, in the main, needs to look at itself all the time. I have to say that of the major sports, the sport that I think has made the biggest improvements in its presentation has been swimming. If you go to a swimming event now, the athletes all emerge from a central point at the back of the pool. That started in the Manchester Evening News Arena with the short course championships many years ago. That's become standard. A swimming event is 1 hour, 50 minutes, a couple of heats, so many finals, two finals, three medal presentations, and you're out. And that suits television, and that works. Some other sports take quite a long time. And I think sport needs to look at itself all the time. And the better sport can make itself, then the easier it will be for the host city to welcome it.
We're going to come to the floor in a moment for some Q&A, but one thing I wanted to sort of drill the panel on a little bit further is, how do you keep driving innovation? Because, you know, if you look at traditional organising committees, you know, what they want to do is just make sure that the event is delivered, and yet, as has been discussed, everything from presentation through to the nature of the legacy requires innovation. So, David, wearing your new hat at the Commonwealth Games Federation, you've got the Gold Coast coming up in 2018 and Durban in 2022. What are you doing to keep those who are going to be organising the next cycle of Commonwealth Games innovating in the way that suits the brand of the Commonwealth Games itself?
Two words: relevance and resonance. And I think it's maintaining your relevance and also continuing to resonate. And if there's anything that I think the Commonwealth Games Federation has learned over the past several years, I think from Kuala Lumpur through Manchester all the way to the recent success in Glasgow and on to Gold Coast and of course in Durban in 2022, and most recently our youth games in Samoa, is ensuring that our events are now associated with a much, much bigger cause. That how do our events, you know, create peaceful environments, you know, whether that's promoting rights or whether that's helping reconcile long-standing issues. How do we drive a more sustainable approach within cities, and how do we also help people prosper? And if sport and citizens and, of course, athletes and communities can drive that, then we stay relevant. So it's actually creating a model for the Federation, and through the power of our events and also the other activities that the Federation runs, that all pushes towards some of these really relevant issues that both resonate and ultimately, you know, deliver real, and I think the word is, impact. I think Craig said it, and of course Bridget also said it. You know, cities opposed to nations. Nations are very, very important in getting that buy-in and that oversight, but really where the impact is experienced, felt, and ultimately you're judged as a success or not, it's with the citizens of the cities. So, you know, how do we invoke real positive citizenship and invoke a really great experience from beginning to end? You know, it's not just the destination of 11 days of great sporting competition that really matters. It's the journey. Why do people want to bid? Why do people want this to come? And if they don't value it, it won't be valued. And that's, I think that's it. So giving people access, giving people inclusion, creating the right narratives that are not just authentic but very, very sincere in the proposition and deliver. You know, that's certainly the approach that the Federation, in terms of the Commonwealth Games Federation, and its newly refreshed vision and approach through Transformation 2022 is looking to take, fully recognizing that we're not the panacea, but we can contribute to peaceful, sustainable, and prosperous communities. Thank you.
And Bridget, from your point of view, you know, driving innovation, keeping people thinking creatively, what's been the key to that in Glasgow?
I think it has been said earlier that certainly in Glasgow and in Scotland more widely, and I'm sure many other countries, the main funders of sports and cultural events and programmes are governments at national and local level, ultimately the taxpayer. And that relevance has to be proven both to them, but also to the wider public who are ultimately paying for it. I would hope that one of the things you would have experienced during the Commonwealth Games, during last week's gymnastics and many other events that happen in our city, whether you're going to one of our museums, which are incidentally the most visited museums outside of London, 3.5 million visitors a year, our concert hall and now the arena, some of the best and most visited venues, not just in Scotland but in Europe. I think that is a constant striving to make sure that people are engaged, are persuaded, and you're seen to build in success. And I can't say enough how important it is that people see real results at a local level, both during but most importantly before and after the event. And for us, you know, our links with our sports development teams, with our cultural and arts workers, all of that has been to ensure that, yes, they deliver a brilliant event, but more importantly for them, that people are engaged before. I think one of the great things, just to talk about venue development, one of the wonderful things that was said about the new and additional venues that were built for the Commonwealth Games was that they belong to the people of Glasgow. That was quoted regularly in the press by influencers, decision makers, but most importantly by the public. And they were open to them and available before the Games and were opened again within 3 to 4 weeks. So putting the taxpayer who's paying for this at the forefront, and I think in the current economic situation across the world at the moment that we are facing, and the increasing, the transparency that's being demanded around mega events and public expenditure, you really, really have to show that you are connected to local people's long-term interests and needs and rooted in community.
Carol, one of the things that we try and do in the campaigns we're involved in is bring surprises to the narrative and what a city might be offering to an international federation or the IOC in terms of staging. From your experience of the Capital of Culture, which one surprised you most in terms of their approach, how they created a difference, how they perhaps brought out an element of their culture that you didn't know was there? Which one would you give as a very good example of surprise innovation?
Well, I think that most of them are rather surprising. Over the last couple of years, we have had capitals which have more and more frequently been basing their program on the experiences which they got from the others. And this is, you know, we have this whole family of former capitals who now informally meet, and they inform each other, and they have kind of even elaborated a kind of guidance or guide, you know, so that they don't commit the same mistake, that they don't kick into open doors, and so that each capital is slightly better than the previous ones because they learn from the mistakes of the others. And from this point of view, I've mentioned Košice, but for instance, Mons, which is the European Capital of Culture this year, which is a 70,000 strong town in Belgium, in a part of Belgium which was a complete desert a couple of years ago because of the, you know, post-industrial era and all the factories and mines closing down and so on. And the city has had, since the beginning of the year, 1.3 million visitors, already, because it managed not only to open a couple of museums and stage a very good program, but because they brought in people from all over Europe who are kind of very dedicated to the new digital technologies, and they have developed the Europa Café concept from 13 or 14 cities around Europe, and you have hundreds and hundreds of young people who participate every day in exchanges with online direct exchanges with the 13 cities, with all kinds of street art and cultural programs, you know, and so on. But of course, this somehow wakes up their imagination, and this is something which is really attractive for the young generation. So this is just a small example of what can trigger the interest of the local population, and even of the youngsters who normally would never ever be interested in anything cultural, not even passively, you know, but they do it because it is something which is very close to their everyday life, with the mobile phones and with the tablets and so on. All of a sudden, they are drawn into this. So this is, I think, a good example. This year in Mons, a very small town in Belgium, which is being visited by hundreds of thousands of people.
Thank you. We're going to hear more from Craig later, so I'm going to open up to questions from the floor. There are working microphones at both doors at the top. So if you indicate, if you do wish to ask a question or make a point, and then just tell us who you are and which organisation you're representing. There's a colleague at the front here, yeah.
Thanks. Thank you. Yeah, my name is Ignacio Packer. I work for a child rights organisation called Terre des Hommes, with the Children Win campaign. And here, yeah, build for things that are appropriate. I think that's so central. The other element that really is central is people-centered, and that came out in several of the interventions and talked about rights, of course. How events and cities innovate to thrive, we can use old parts. And there is the UN human rights and business principles that really have to be in the core of the work that we do. And it's the responsibilities of corporates towards whatever we do. And actually, next week there is the Human Rights Forum on human rights and business in Geneva. And more attention is given to mega sporting events. So innovation also comes using existing tools, but applying them. And I think it's almost for all of us to see how are we using them, eh? Because having a client like Qatar 2022, you can question, are we really doing all what we can to use these guiding principles which are really, really key. So here's not so much a question, but it's to really insist that we have things that implementing them would be innovations, because we have them on the table, and certainly the reference to the human rights and business principles is absolutely key.
Thank you. As you say, there wasn't a question, but it's a very good point. Any other colleagues would like to ask a question or raise a point?
Mike, can I just pick up on that?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
About I think one of the things, and I'm sure David will agree, that we're hugely proud of in the Commonwealth Games was our partnership with UNICEF for the opening ceremony, where we made sure that rather than being perceived simply as a city that was spending millions of pounds on fireworks and wonderful content, that we actually used it as an opportunity to raise money for children across the Commonwealth. And I think that resonated so much with the values of both the city and the Commonwealth Games. And it was important that it was not just a symbol for us, but that it fed into our later relationship. And we now are on the verge of signing a memorandum of understanding with UNICEF around a number of other events, both cultural and sporting. And again, making sure that young people, not just in our country, in our city, but those across the world who we have a responsibility for too, are reflected not just, you know, in our thoughts, but actually in our actions as well. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, indeed. UNICEF was very innovative and very striking in its effect. Any other questions or points? I think we won't take you next, Ben. We'll take a colleague here.
Hello, good morning, everyone. My name is Guido Bouw from InfoStrada Sports. We work a lot with events, and many times we see that the event really is engaging around the games itself. But then when it is over, public engagement slows down or falls away. Organizing committees dissolve. So in the time between two events, for instance, the Commonwealth Games or any other games, what can a federation do to either have those lessons learned and best practices move to the next organizing committee, so they don't have to reinvent the wheel, which sometimes happens? And then the other way, it's how can we keep engaging the public on the Commonwealth Games, moving forward to Gold Coast, so their road to the next games is somewhat more paved than not there at all.
I think I'll ask Craig to give the first part of that answer. Yeah.
Well, David's thinking what he's going to say. One of the things that can happen is to have a well-organized transfer of knowledge system. It's certainly in place in the International Olympic Committee, and actually it's the whole base of the invitation phase for the Agenda 2020. There is a whole mass of knowledge and information there which we now transfer to prospective bidding cities. For event organisers themselves, a little bit depends on the structure of the company of the country in which you live. We in London were a limited company. Our job was to run the games, and we went out of business. We also went out of business and wound up our accounts faster than any other organising city had. And one of the problems we've had since then is that we, the organising committee, have been accused of not looking after the legacy. With respect, it wasn't our job. Our job was to run the games, not look after the legacy. It's somebody else's operating. But there is one human part of the legacy which works and still works, and that's volunteering. We attracted, I forget how many need, 70,000 volunteers for the London Games, and we taught them all. And it was interesting to go to the Rugby World Cup, which is the next big event held in this. The same volunteers, and many of the same people, different uniform, were doing the same things. Big smile, hello, welcome, nice to see you. Over there, this is the way you go in, your buses is there, the ladies' toilet is down there. Everything done to improve the enjoyment of the spectator coming to the event. So it does work, and in a human terms, I think it certainly works in this country. The issue on legacy is an entirely different one and a much wider political argument.
Yeah, I think that one of the key things maybe David would comment in a Glasgow context, is organising committees are there to organise the particular event. They need to be as creative, as innovative, deliver as much as they possibly can. But the partnerships that have to be put in place for how legacy is going to be delivered have to begin even at the bid phase. So there's a question of how you work with your stakeholders and how you have a legacy plan that is in there early, but as a part of an understanding across the different stakeholders, including city and central government, is crucial. Organising committees can't be expected to deliver once they've been dissolved. David?
I think use Glasgow as an example. In the bid, three words were used: people, place, passion. And that was, how do we align everything to that? We are, again, and I said this, I think, when I first started speaking, was that we were here for a very short period of time, the guests in town. How do we make sure that the approach that we take is owned, embraced, and really essentially that the municipal rights holders, not just the commercial rights holders, but the municipal rights holders, the citizens of the city, actually feel that this was all worth it. And so, a year after, 10 years after, a generation after, say it was all worth it, we'd do it again. And, that speaks, goes for itself. And I think the way that you do that is, I think, one of the great examples that Bridget used was, absolutely ensuring that you have your various agencies, public, private, and third sector, intimately involved in the successful delivery of the games. Our whole culture, ceremonies, and, of course, our Queen's Baton Relay program would not have been as impactful if we didn't have all the great partners like Glasgow Life and so forth driving that initiative forward. Glasgow Life and many of the other partners that they were able to mobilize through Creative Scotland and countless other groups were an enormous factor, the factor in the success of the resonance of that element of the games, and that, you know, created municipal buy-in. So I think from that standpoint, that legacy endures, you know, in terms of how you approach delivering an event in Glasgow. One of the things that we, one more example, including community benefit clauses in tenders. So as an organizing committee, almost every single tender that we put out there had a community benefit clause. If you want to do business in Glasgow, what's in it for Glasgow? And that's actually quite a mature way of looking at it, is that this is not for the short term, this is for the long term in terms of the investment. And that certainly reaped benefits in terms of, you know, subcontracting and also skills and employability for local people. And I think that, you know, working with that conscience, certainly, I think to answer your question, embeds a sense of trust, but then also leaves a living legacy, if you will, in terms of people's ambitions and effectiveness in delivering great events, sporting or cultural or the like.
Thank you. Do you want to add a line, Bridget?
Could I just say something about the evidence of all that's been said? One of the big things we learned with the European Capital of Culture in 1990 was that we didn't put enough peer research, you know, university engagement to show that there was genuine evidence. Anecdotes are important, but it's not evidence in its own right. I think I can honestly say now that Glasgow and Scotland have bucked the trend. Our figures for participation in both sport and museum attendances astonishingly went up both during the Commonwealth Games, but we are now seeing that our participation numbers have continued to go up. Our junior clubs has quadrupled in membership. Our numbers of accredited clubs across the city have actually, you know, threefold what they were before. And I think we know that I would like to say something about evidence. We involved the universities in the city at a very early stage in gathering that information. And they were very critical friends, very, very critical in a negative way sometimes. But it is important that you bring that objectivity and actually show. And that model that we spoke about being rooted in your city, in the policies, which can see, you know, seem like jargon sometimes, to be actually rooted in real need, we are now seeing that, and that will deliver results. And importantly, to be rooted in organisations who had a vested interest in the long-term engagement of the population. And a lot of those people were seconded to work for the Commonwealth Games itself, and a number of them actually, as Colin and those involved in the Life Sites team, were involved through Glasgow Life. So they had a stake in their longer-term targets. It wasn't just about the Games, and I think that that approach we can now evidence as being a success. And in fact, one of the key academics from this university in Strathclyde, Robert Rogerson, has just published a book. I think its title is the True Story Behind the Games, which sounds very intriguing, but a lot of it does actually give that hard and fast evidence. And there are other researchers in other universities if you were interested in pursuing it.
Well, speaking about participation, feeling of ownership, and enthusiasm and passion, I think this is really important, because, you know, in many cases you have, above all, let's say in the new member states where you don't have that much public money available, people have the tendency to say before the start of the European Capital of Culture program, why so much money is spent on this? Wouldn't it be better to spend it on social welfare? Wouldn't it be better to, you know, to enlarge the hospital, whatever? And you never really know in advance how strong this feeling of rejection is. And I just remembered an anecdote from Riga 2 years ago, at the beginning of January or mid-January. It was. And it was minus 20 degrees, and they just opened the new library of Latvia at the bank of the Daugava River. and people were asked to contribute with books to the new library. There's going to be a special section of books donated by the population. 20,000 people turned out in the streets. From all parts of the city, you had long queues of people handing the books from one to each other in special packs, minus 20 degrees. They were there for five or six hours, and they filled the library with these books. And from this moment on, it was very clear that the population is there and that they are going to participate throughout the year. And it really happened.
Before we go to maybe the final question, I wanted to quote Sir Craig Reedy when he spoke to the IOC at the Singapore session in our final pitch as London 2012 bid. I'm paraphrasing Craig, but it was along the lines, if you grant us the right to host the Olympic and Paralympic Games, we promise to nourish and cherish and hand it back to you in even better shape, along those lines. Well, that's because you were speaking in French. That's the one. The reason I mention that is because I think one of the conversations that we haven't touched on here, but it'll come up maybe in some of the forthcoming sessions, is also for the rights holders, for the international federations, for the IOC, for those bodies who are granting you the right to host their event, they want it to be improved. They want it to be almost rebranded with the flavour of your city and your country, and they want it to come back even stronger. So there is a legacy here as well for the event, for the championship, for the federation or the rights holder that needs to also be at the forefront of good thinking. So we'll take any final questions? Yes.
Hi, my name is Paul Dunphy from Sport Business. So I've been coming to these conferences about sort of 8 years now. And one of the things I notice is that we're all suited up. We're sort of middle-aged and older. If you go to a truly high-tech conference, they'll be wearing T-shirts and jeans and young. So I want to know where the true innovators are. How come we aren't getting young people to these conferences? And what's their role in sport and creating innovation for world sport? Just thought I'd throw it out there.
Who's the youngest person on the platform?
David.
I think your point's absolutely right. You know, I mean, I've heard various points made in the past couple of years. You know, sport is male, pale, and stale, and I've heard it described in different ways. We absolutely need to do more to ensure that young people are being nurtured and brought in as successors to this. You know, if we look at I'll go back to my Commonwealth example, is that we have 2.3 billion citizens in the Commonwealth. One in every three people in the world is a Commonwealth citizen. 1.6 billion are under the age of 24. We have an absolute responsibility to ensure that sport and major events and our industry isn't being done to them. It is being done by them. And so I think to your point, I think it is just, ensuring that they're engaged, ensuring that it is attractive, relevant, resident, and communicates well with them. And this is something that they want to be a part of, and that they know they can have impact through. And that is through active citizenship. So awareness, advocacy, action. And, those are the three, principles I think sport have a great role to engage young people with.
Yeah, I think the other thing to add, and maybe from an IOC perspective, is that this is a debate that's been going on for some time. And I think a combination of changing the sports program with the addition, for example, of surfing, skateboarding and sports climbing into Tokyo 2020 is a sign of an interest in having more youth-orientated sports. And obviously, the whole new world of digital communications. And if you look, for example, at the thinking and the vision behind Youth Olympic Games 2018 in Buenos Aires, that's at the forefront of it. That they're striving to become the first ever truly digital Youth Olympic Games, and where better to start than the Youth Olympic Games. So it's a very good point. You have to ask Ben and Matthew about getting more young people in the audience. I see quite a few youngish people, but it's a big debate, and maybe as we go through the next couple of days, we'll keep returning to it. So on that note, can I just say on your behalf, thank you to a tremendous panel. Thank you for your questions and contributions, and look forward to seeing you throughout the next 2 days. Thanks very much.